Sometime in 1908, two very high masts appeared in Jedrick Street, Randwick, and eventually wires formed into long cages were stretched between these masts, which caused me to wonder. This, I discovered, was the first experimental wireless telegraph station of the late Reverend Father Shaw.
The ABC Social History Unit presents Bright Sparks, Australian radio stories, compiled by Stephen Rapley. This first program, The Wireless Priest.
He's a boy from the bush, very rough and ready, that's what his own words, rough and ready, but I do try to do my best. He's a simple sort of man and a very, very good man in many ways, but not a man wise in the ways of the world. He went his own way, did his own thing, and expected other people to accept the doing of his own thing.
Long before radio broadcasting was even thought about, the new mysterious technology of sending signals through space without any connecting wires was a constant and noisy issue on the Australian political agenda.
Look at the top of the line of the bricks. It's just like in a photo.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
That's the top line of stones.
That's right.
I'm sure those old buildings were all part of the original thing.
And that was what in the original layout? The infirmary? The sanatorium? The
sanatorium, I think, right. Yeah.
And now it's a powder magazine.
I don't know what it is now, a magazine of some sort.
From the moment news first arrived in Australia of the earliest wireless experiments of Heinrich Hertz and Guglielmo Marconi, local scientists and experimenters across the continent began winding spark coils, rigging aerial systems, and stirring up the ether. A Catholic priest, Father Archibald Shaw, who got his wireless experimenter's license in 1910, stirred up so much trouble that it led to a royal commission, the resignation of a senator, and the sacking of a minister. Wireless was first used for communication between ships at sea and radio stations on the coast. Early development of the technology was stifled by a stranglehold over patents held by the major companies, Telefunken and Marconi. When the first two coastal radio stations were set up in Sydney and Perth, the successful tender was from the German firm, Telefunken. But later, because of the Labor government policy favouring Australian manufacturers, Father Shaw was to supply the equipment for the next 17 stations. Father John McMahon is the archivist at the Missionaries of the Sacred Heart in Sydney. Recently he took me on a tour of the site of Father Shaw's wireless station and the wireless factory, Australia's first, in the Sydney suburb of Randwick.
Where would he have been operating the transmitter from?
I think he would have operated from the top room of this building here, in that corner room there, I think.
And this is Ascot, the house they lived in?
This is Ascot, the house that Father Shaw and Mr. Kirkby and his two sons actually all lived in this house here, together with the mission procurator, who was Father Gui at that time. Father Shaw was the assistant procurator, and they all lived together in this house.
Was it normal for lay people to...
most unusual to do that sort of thing, but Father Shaw had a liberal interpretation of rules, shall we say, and he believed in having his workmen living on the spot, and they didn't have a place to live at any rate, so it was convenient for everybody.
So it was charity more than a business arrangement?
Oh, no, it was a practical arrangement, I'd say, and he was quite happy for them to live there, but I don't think his confreres in religion, especially his superiors, didn't frown a bit on this sort of arrangement, I think, and they made it clear to him on various occasions. He was on the outer a bit, you know, with regard to his religious superiors, because he's a very unusual sort of man. Very unusual sort of man.
Tell me what you know about him. What the character?
Well, he's a country boy. His mother and father died very early. He was only about eight or so. And the family brought him up. Various relations. He went from relation to relation, I think. And he went to school at Tumut, which is not very far from Adelong, where he was born. But he had a very tough existence, I'd say, and a few photos I have of him show him to a real typical Ginger Meggs schoolboy, you know, of the day, and not clothes not very good. I don't know about having shoes on his feet, but he had that sort of existence. He lived very harsh life, and he brought up very harshly, I'd say, too.
How was it that Shaw first started making radio? Was that an experimental thing that he did in the evenings?
Well, first of all, Father Shaw had to raise money for the missions. He'd worked in the missions as a young man for a year or so, 2 years. He came down to Sydney to continue his education and finish his education so he could be ordained a priest. He's okay. He was ordained a priest in 1900, and he was the first Australian-born priest for the missionaries of the Sacred Heart in Australia. So then he was appointed procurator of the missions. That meant looking after three tremendous missions. There was the French mission in Papua New Guinea, what is now Papua, and also in Rabaul, was staffed by German missionaries of the Sacred Heart, and a third mission in the Gilbert Islands, staffed by French missionaries of the Sacred Heart. And Father Shaw's job was to coordinate all the effort to send materials, medicines, building materials, food, anything was needed for the missions. Father Shaw's job was to assist the procurator to send those materials to the missions. Well, he tried to raise, never had enough money, of course, so he had to try to raise some money by painting. He'd paint enormous canvases, 10 feet by 10, and sell them. He used to get about £50 for each canvas, and he had a bit of success, but obviously there's no money in painting. They weren't original works. There's nothing creative about it. He did copies of old masters, of resurrections and crucifixions and angels and all this sort of thing. And he used to sell these things and raise money for the missions. But after a while, he realized that there was no money at all in this. So he decided to investigate the possibility of wireless. He'd been interested in wireless since he was a young fellow. He'd worked in the post office in Goulburn, and he was interested in wireless, and he decided to try and make wirelesses. So, purely by accident, he came across a chap called Mr. Kirkby. Kirkby had two sons working with him. He had an entrepreneur or manufacturer at this stage. And he'd actually make the instruments, and Father Shaw would draw the plans.
In no time at all, success crowned our efforts. Mr. Kirkby then asked my consent to make up these instruments for public use, and if he sold any, I would get half the profits. If there is none sold, the men lose nothing, as they are not depending on them for their daily bread. If there is a sale, the men get half the profits and give me, us, half. I may state that the timber merchants gave me timber to build my masts, and as I was already doing good work in wireless, and on that account got a certain amount of publicity, so that when a storm came and blew down the masts, people came and offered me money, Catholic and Protestants, to put up a steel tower.
Do you think Father Shaw had a flair for publicity, for public relations?
No, I don't think so, really. If anything, I think he was inclined to downplay this area. For instance, there's an article in the Daily Telegraph that you will have read in which his name is not even mentioned, even though it's all about him and his works. He's not the one to push his own barrow, as they say, but he didn't mind having the reputation of being a wireless expert, if you like. I suppose you take a legitimate pride in that sort of thing.
The Daily Telegraph story in February 1911 was headlined, "The Biggest Station in Australia." Tower at Randwick, 250 feet high. A few days later, there was another photo featuring Father Shaw, Kirkby, and more than a dozen of his apprentices at the base of the gigantic antenna tower. With Father Shaw, they'd all volunteered to come to the rescue of the missing administrator of Papua, Staniforth Smith. Shaw knew Smith from his time in Papua and took his team to Port Moresby to put together an ambitious network of 6 wireless stations to guide the search. But before it was all finally set up, Smith and the remnants of his party returned. 2 years later, when the Port Moresby coastal radio station went on the air, it was one of the 17 other stations around the country equipped with wireless gear made at Shaw's Maritime Wireless Company in Randwick.
2 rotary spark gaps with 30 and 36 teeth, respectively, mounted on insulated base and enclosed in soundproof box. 1 tuner, comprising three condensers and two transformers, one anchor gap, one magnetic detector, one tuner, receiver and telephone shore system. 3,000 feet antenna wire.
Now, the other thing is that there seems to be a bit of antagonism from the order, from the local people in the order, to the work he was doing.
Yes, this happens sometimes. Father Shaw was very much approved of by Cardinal Morin, who was a great man for the worker, the working man. At least he gave out that impression to people. He's also genuinely, I think, trying to better the conditions of the worker. But he also is a great believer in clergy and priests being scientific in their work and being scientists even in their work. And he's very much in favour of Father Shaw continuing with his scientific work in wireless telegraphy. But his own local clergy, the missionaries of the Sacred Heart, who were doing parish work, pastoral work, and the work that a priest has to do, they felt that this scientific interest and this interest in wireless telegraphy was taking him away from priestly work that they thought he should be doing.
I am aware that some of the fathers do not like me working wireless for fear it might bring trouble through the cardinal disapproving of it. I thought it my duty to see the cardinal on that point, telling him everything and that perhaps it might bring in a little money. He was delighted and gave me his blessing, saying that if I needed any little financial help, his secretary would assist me. He also hoped that I would make it a life study, as he wished all his priests to be leaders in science and to help in every way the working classes. When going to New Guinea to help find the lost governor, His Eminence sent for me again, giving me his blessing, asking me all my plans, etc., and said when I was leaving that by this action I was raising the priesthood and the church in the eyes of the government and the people of Australia.
Shaw was enjoying great technical success. He had the support of the Fisher Labour government, who favoured the Australian company over its German and even British competitors. While Telefunken and Marconi took Father Shaw to court for violating their patents, the Crown solicitor not only fought the cases for him, but even guaranteed to pay all damages if Shaw lost.
Certainly had a personal relationship with one senator in the cabinet in Melbourne, and that was Senator Long. And Senator Long's son was working in his wireless shop, or in his wireless works at Randwick, and he shared with Senator Long a certain interest in racehorses. That wasn't because he lived in Randwick, I don't think, but he and Senator Long, at any rate, used to pick winners in Melbourne, always in Melbourne racecourses, never in Sydney, I don't know why. And he was very friendly with Senator Long, and Long was very good to him.
The patents battle was eventually resolved, but Father Shaw's wireless works were to suffer from something more damaging. Labour lost the elections in June 1913 to Joseph Cook's Liberal Party. Labour didn't regain power until September 1914, just after the outbreak of the First World War. But for Father Shaw, it was too late. On the 3rd of December that year, Shaw's close friend, Senator James Long, proposed the setting up of a government-owned wireless works.
There has been established for some time in Australia a factory specially equipped for the construction of wireless material. This factory, I'm glad to say, received considerable encouragement from the Labour government when they were in office from 1910 to 1913. It was in consequence of the support received from the Labour government and the activity displayed by that government in linking Australia up with a chain of wireless stations, and those interested were induced to import special machinery at a high cost to equip their works thoroughly, so as to undertake the manufacture of wireless plant and material. But when the Labour government was superseded by the late Cook ministry, strange to say, every effort was made to boycott the works. I make bold to say that during the regime of the late Cook government, that factory, with 250 skilled, capable young Australian workmen, didn't receive sixpenneth worth of government work. Not only did the late Cook government not encourage this fine Australian industry, but they did all they could to place obstacles in its way and to assist its competitors, known as the Amalgamated Wireless, a combination of the German Telefunken and the Marconi companies. The Australian interest of those companies was combined for the purpose of defeating the Commonwealth system. An Australian invention that was assigned to the federal government without any cost to the country. And I regret to say that this movement, in a great measure, succeeded. When the war broke out on the 5th of August this year, there was considerable demand for wireless plants, and the then Minister for Defence purchased a number of them from the German company, while hundreds of young Australians capable of manufacturing them were walking the streets of Sydney looking for work.
Father Shaw found himself in a liquidity crisis. At the same time, antagonism from within his own order increased.
To make matters short and clear, were you to order me to leave the Procure, I could not attend to the wireless, and without me the company would break up, and I would have it on my conscience. Also the £20,000 the gentlemen have put in my patents. So I would be placed in a very awkward position. I'm doing my best under very trying circumstances, and it is often 2 a.m. in the morning before I get to bed and turn out at 5. But I'm not doing it for myself, but for the Procure.
While the money from the government suddenly dried up, his suppliers demanded payment, and his finances were in a state of confusion, both the wireless works and the missions.
Well, his superiors in Rome sent a visitor out to investigate the whole question of the Shaw wireless works, and they found that it was chaotic, that he had been mixing up money for wireless with money for the missions. And he had used a lot of money that was meant for the missions, the three missions that he was supposed to be looking after. He was using a lot of that money to buy material for his wireless works. He thought it was a good thing because he was on the crest of a wave, as I said, and, you know, his future was assured. So he said, oh, it's okay, I'll be able to get that money back very easily. But that's not the way business works. Because all the money that the profit made from selling wirelesses, all that profit was ploughed back into the business to make it viable. I mean, there's no way it could support itself. You had to plough money back in. So eventually they reached a stage of complete chaos, and Father Shaw signed a document to the effect that £8,000, that's pounds sterling, of course, and year in those years was quite a bit of money, £8,000 of mission money had been spent on buying a wireless equipment. So having signed that document, he was told by his superior, by the visitator, to sell the whole caboose.
Father Shaw was to spend the next and last 2 years of his life negotiating the sale of his maritime wireless company to the Commonwealth Government in Melbourne. Eventually, in August 1916, with Long's help, he sold the works to the Navy for £57,000. Cut off from overseas supplies of wireless equipment because of the war, the Navy was keen to make its own. Shaw's competitors, Amalgamated Wireless, were amazed at the high value placed on what they claimed was a factory full of obsolete equipment. From the moment Father Shaw withdrew the money from his bank in Melbourne, the story took a mysterious turn.
He stayed at the Coffee Palace Hotel in Mufti. He was travelling on business, and at that time, of course, it was a big deal getting £50,000 sterling for anything at all, and he travelled in Mufti, or in disguise, if you like to put it that way, and the local priest didn't know he was there, certainly, and he got the money and banked the money on the Saturday morning, say, and he immediately paid cheques, which were traced soon afterwards, to various creditors, people he owed money to, in the business world. And then he withdrew one cheque for £5,000 sterling. Went back to his hotel. He met Senator Long and handed over to him some of the money that he received as a kind of a payment, as Senator Long said, I think, for his kindness to him. Then he went back to his hotel, and he was found the next morning unconscious on the floor. As far as I know, he remained in a coma until he died.
Many facts didn't emerge until 2 years after his death, when a royal commission set up to investigate the administration of the Navy focused their attention on the Navy's purchase of Father Shaw's wireless works. Shaw had cashed a cheque just before he died for £5,300. No one knew where that money went. James Butchart was the bank manager.
He came to my room, as far as I remember, with that money in his possession. And he had told me he was leaving for Sydney, I think, the next day, or possibly the day after. So I said, "Surely you're not going to Sydney with all that money in your possession. Let me give you our bank's cheque in exchange for the notes, as that will be much safer." He put his hands on my shoulder and said, "Mind your own business," and smiled. And I think that is where our conversation ended.
Several people alleged that Shaw paid over £5,000 in four sealed bundles to different people for their help in the sale. The main target of the Royal Commission was the Navy Minister, Jensen.
Jensen was very, to me, it seemed a very honest sort of chap at the Royal Commission and afterwards. I find it hard to believe that Jensen was crooked. But Long, I think, would stretch a point to help a friend.
Senator Long admitted to the Royal Commission that he'd received £1,390 from Shaw as a repayment of loans and a token of friendship. When they searched his accounts, they found that a couple of weeks after this, he banked £2,400. The extra £1,000 was explained as unusual luck at the racetrack.
Do you remember Father Shaw coming to see you at Parliament House on the 19th of August, 1916, or any other date in August?
Possibly he did. That's the date upon which I received money from him. Is that a Saturday?
On the 19th of August, there was a cheque drawn by Father Shaw for £5,300. It was a Saturday.
I saw him on a Saturday somewhere about that time.
Where?
At Parliament House.
Whereabouts at Parliament House?
In the Senate club room.
Was anyone present in the club room?
No, that is to say, after the messenger who showed him in.
Was Mr. Jensen in Melbourne on that date?
I couldn't tell you, presumably.
Was Senator Gardner in Melbourne on that date?
I have no idea.
Was Senator Russell?
Well, no idea.
Did Father Shaw give you anything?
Yes, he gave me some money.
How was it done up?
Just in a roll of notes.
Was it done up in a packet?
No, just the notes rolled without any covering whatever.
What did he say to you?
He said to me, "Thank God I got the whole thing fixed up. Look, Jim, old man, I'll never forget you for your kindness. I don't know what I owe you, but I think this will square us." He handed me the money. I was sitting in the big chair and he half embraced me and left the club room. I never saw him afterwards conscious.
The commission's findings were handed down. Long eventually resigned after a futile demand for a judicial inquiry into the purchase. The Order of the Missionaries of the Sacred Heart were not represented at the commission, and neither was Shaw there to defend his reputation, which took a battering.
Royal commissions are strangers, and nobody really can be pinpointed. And you can't drag out the truth from people in a royal commission. You can say what you like. And some of the accusations against Father Shaw, they could have been true, particularly with his personal dealings with people, his personal relationships with Miss Evie Hoad, for instance. What she says is uncorroborated stuff. But, I mean, you've got to accept the fact that she probably told the truth.
Did you see Father Shaw again?
Yes. He said he was going to try and sell to the government, and that he would have a little trouble, he thought, but thought it would come off.
He said lots of things.
He said it would get Long and Jensen to work, and that he did not think he would have any trouble in getting them to sell.
Now, what were the exact relations between you and Father Shaw?
He had asked me to marry him 2 years before he died, and he was just waiting until he got everything settled up.
How long had you known him?
Well, my father had known him since he was a boy. I knew him since March or April 1913 or 1914.
And was it in 1914 he asked you to marry him?
Yes.
He was then a priest, as you understood?
Yes.
And still remained in the church?
Yes. He said he would leave the church as soon as he could. As a matter of fact, he asked me several times to marry him secretly. But of course I would not do
and
that.
And he still remained a priest of the church?
I suppose so.
Your relations were of the utmost intimacy, were they not?
What do you mean by that?
Sexual intercourse took place between you?
No.
Never?
No.
Do you swear that?
Yes. I went to see him many times in his
house. Do you swear that sexual intercourse never took place between you and Father Shaw?
Yes, I do.
Used you to visit him at his house?
Yes, very often.
Alone?
Sometimes alone and sometimes with my sister.
Did you go on trips with him?
Never. Except the time we came from my own home to Sydney, that's all.
Did you promise to marry him?
Yes.
And you considered you were an engaged couple after this promise had been made?
Yes.
What was his idea as soon as the works were sold?
To go off to America. Either that or he would go first and I and my sister should follow.
Happened to him? Was he murdered? Did he die accidentally? Did he fall over? Did he have a heart attack? Goodness knows what happened. We don't know really, except that his superior in Sydney cabled Rome to the effect that he died from apoplexy. That was a very general term in those days, died from apoplexy, and we still really don't know what happened. But he died in Melbourne. Body was brought to Sydney. Great fuss about his funeral. Archbishop Kelly presided, said the mass. And all the men who worked for him, at one stage there were 171 men working here, they all marched behind his coffin to Ranwick Cemetery, and he was buried with a great deal of style, if you like, in Ranwick Cemetery.
Eventually, Jensen, the former Navy Minister, was sacked. The missing money was never found, and the Order of the Sacred Heart spent 6 years in the courts, trying in vain to recover the money Shaw had embezzled. The works which helped establish Australia's coastal radio service became a Navy workshop. Today, the site of the country's first radio factory is an Army storage depot.
One evening, I found myself standing in a large room housing Father Shaw's wireless station. Here, surrounded by huge coils of silver-plated copper tube, transformers, Leyden jar condensers, and of all the equipment of the fascinating tuners and instruments for receiving, I became captured by the magic spark, and I believe my destiny being sealed at that point of time. I can still smell the sweet, nostalgic odour of the ozone generated by the spark discharge, and the sweet odour of shellac, varnish, insulation of those days, and of ebonite, which form the beautiful shiny panels of the receiving equipment.
Ray Allsop, one of the most famous of the early generation of Australian radio engineers to be trained by Father Shaw. After a few years' apprenticeship, Shaw advised him to go to sea as a ship's wireless operator. The next program in Bright Sparks is about this work, Ship to Shore. In The Wireless Priest, you heard Father John McMahon, archivist with the Missionaries of the Sacred Heart Monastery at Kensington in New South Wales. Father Shaw's letters were read by John Clayton, and extracts from the Royal Commission evidence by Michelle Forden, Stuart McCreary and Vincent Ball. The interview with Ray Allsop was from the ABC Radio Archives. Music for the series was written and performed by Kathy Peters. Bright Sparks is produced by Sharon Davis, Judy Lowry and Stephen Rapley for the ABC Social History Unit.
You know me as a rough man, but my intentions are always for the welfare of our order. I hate fighting and wrangling and wish to live at peace with all.